now let's meet a man who tells us that he was a freelance toilet trainer. But who cares? Ladies and gentlemen, I'm not sure if this man's name is Carl Oliver or Oliver Carl, but here he comes anyway. Both of them. Come on out here, Carl Oliver.
Gonna clear up, put on a happy face. Wipe off that frown and cheer up, put on a happy face.
Well, the infamous Gong Show was a stage for amateur and usually terrible performers. Its creator and host, Chuck Barris, has died. We'll remember him later in the show. First, though, all right, now to L.A.'s entertainment industry. The Writers Guild of America is negotiating a new 3-year contract with film and TV producers, this during a time of so-called peak TV. There are more than 450 series this season, twice as many shows as several years ago. There is also a surge in the number of TV writers, but their wages have been flat. Stress over money is stirring up talks of a strike. And joining us now is Jonathan Handel, entertainment and technology lawyer and contributing editor at The Hollywood Reporter. Welcome back.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be back with you.
Great to have you. All right. So there are more TV series out now, and yet wages aren't going up. That seems to violate the laws of supply and demand.
Well, except it turns out that it doesn't. I was a computer scientist and applied math guru before law school, and I put that hat on and asked myself, how many episodes of TV are getting produced these days? Because, you know, a series is one thing, but it's actually the episodes. That, you know, someone doesn't write a series, they write an episode. It turns out, it was very hard to get data, but I got data from Professor Darnell Hunt at UCLA's Bunch Center for African American Studies, who's been studying media, bias issues, mm-hmm. and had episode counts over a period of 4 years. And over a period of 4 years, ending a year or two ago, the number of series went up by 50%, but the number of episodes actually briefly dipped and ultimately only went up by 6%. So peak TV is not as peak as it sounds.
So these series just have fewer episodes is the answer.
That's correct. The series have fewer episodes, and it's not just that there are more and more digital series, which tend to be shorter than network series, but that the number of episodes in a typical network series has been driven down. And so overall, the average number of episodes in a season for a series was 18.8, almost 19 episodes a season in 2011. That fell by a factor of a third, down to 13 episodes per season, from 19 down to 13 in just 3 years.
And are there more writers out there clamoring for these jobs?
There are. The number of writers went up during the same period by something like 20 some odd percent. It's gone up by about more like a third over time since 2009. So you had supply, you had demand for labor going up by about 6%. That's the number of episodes, but supply going up by 20% or so.
Okay, so there's the supply and demand question answered as to why wages are flat. So what does this mean in terms of a possible strike?
Well, it does mean that you've got a lot of unhappy writers. And we should say on the movie side, wages have declined, have actually gone down in inflation-adjusted terms. The average wages are down about 21% over a period of several years. But I do think that it's likely that there will not be a strike. There are no guarantees in this life or any other life that people believe in. But we are hearing what one of my sources believes is saber rattling from the union, and I think a little bit of magnification perhaps by or amplification by some other members of the press. There's discomfort, and certainly the only leverage that a union ultimately has is either the threat of a strike or ultimately an actual strike. But if you look at what's going on here, the basic wage increases that they get, that they're going to get for this deal, are almost certainly going to be the same as what the Directors Guild got in their deal several months ago, because there's a parallelism called pattern bargaining that exists from union to union. And that was basically 3% per year. And the other big ticket economic item is residuals. The Directors Guild got some significant improvements in residuals on Netflix and Hulu and various other contexts. And the Writers Guild is going to get essentially the same deal as well, almost certainly. So that leaves this issue of writers' salaries. And the problem for writers is that even with a short series, the writers, and by the way, also the actors, whose negotiations are coming up next, get held from year to year, because if a series gets picked up for the next season, the producer wants the same writers and also the same actors to be available. So you're working on fewer episodes. You do get paid something for the time that you're held, but a lot less than you get paid when you're actually working. And that translates into the what appear to be flat or perhaps even declining earnings that we're seeing.
What is the average salary for a TV writer?
I can't give you a very decent answer on that. I mean, all the Writers Guild releases is the total number of TV writers and the total amount that they earned. But, you know, that's an arithmetic. I want to caution that that's an arithmetic average. You divide the one by the other. Mm-hmm. What people want to think about in their minds is, you know, what is a typical, quote unquote, typical TV writer get? And that's really asking the median. What's the midpoint? Half get less, half get more. And the trouble with the mathematical average, the division of the two numbers, and I know I'm sounding a little wonky, is that it gets pulled up when you've got outliers who are making significantly more money than others. And the fact of the matter is that showrunners, writer-producers, do make significantly more money than staff writers. And so to just divide the Writers Guild figures and come up with an average is not terribly meaningful.
Right. So if you've got a Matt Weiner making millions, that's skewing it.
That exactly right. Exactly right.
Okay, so the last writer strike happened about 10 years ago, and that was huge in the industry. What are the lasting effects from that?
Well, the studios, the lasting effects were particularly great, actually, on the feature side. The studios used the writer strike and the recession that followed really right on its heels, the national recession, as an opportunity to recalibrate the way they hired screenwriters. And instead of guaranteeing a screenwriter, hey, we'd like you to write a draft, and we also guarantee that you can write, do a rewrite or two rewrites and a polish, and you'll get paid for each of those, you know, so-called steps. Instead, the deals these days are much more single-step deals. Write a draft. If we like it, then we might hire you to do a rewrite. And if we like that, we might hire you to do a polish and so forth. And so that and the weakness overall in the motion picture business are what's led to this decline in screenwriter earnings. The TV business, the changes that we've seen, you know, haven't been so much as a result of the strike as they have been a result of changing distribution and consumption patterns. In other words, Netflix and Amazon and the effect that they've had.
All right. We'll keep an eye out on that. Jonathan Handel is an entertainment and technology lawyer who knows a lot about math and a contributing editor at The Hollywood Reporter. Thanks.
Thanks very much.
And if you're a TV writer, we'd like to hear from you. Has it been harder to make a living these days? What are your biggest challenges? You can give us a call at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY or weigh in on our Facebook page at KCRW Press Play. Coming up, more young people are being diagnosed with colon cancer. Why is a mystery? That story next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Over the past few decades, the overall rates of colon and rectal cancers have dropped steadily here in the U.S. But for millennials and some Gen Xers, the opposite is now true. Colorectal cancer rates have been rising at an alarming rate for people in their 20s and 30s, and no one really knows why. Those are the findings in a new study from the American Cancer Society. And joining us to talk about that is Dr. Zuri Morell. He's a colorectal surgeon and the director of the Cedars-Sinai Colorectal Cancer Center here in L.A. Welcome.
Welcome. Well, thank you so much for having me, especially during this month of Colorectal Cancer Awareness Month. So
okay.
Thank you.
We are doing our part to raise awareness. So rates are going down in older people. And is this primarily because they're more likely to be screened?
Yes, it's dropping for patients over the age of 50, and this is really because of colonoscopy and other screening methods. However, in terms of millennials, I think the issue is twofold: is people when people come in with the symptoms that are associated with colorectal cancer, which are really associated with a lot of other common problems that aren't cancer related, then people don't think that that these young people can have cancer, and it still has to be on everyone's mind.
So what are some of those symptoms? They come in maybe to your office, and they present right. with what kinds of symptoms?
So often a millennial will present with rectal bleeding. That's very common, and a lot of times it's because of hemorrhoids, constipation, things of that nature. But what I always try to teach patients, and when I do a lot of public outreach and community service, is that you have to be your own healthcare advocate. What does that mean? That means that if you come to see a doctor and say you have rectal bleeding, and the doctor says it's probably hemorrhoids, first of all, they should take a look. If you see hemorrhoids that are there, you can offer a treatment. But the key is, if the treatment is not making you better over the course of 2 weeks to a month, then it is up to you to go back, talk to your doctor, and say, well, what's next? What's the next treatment algorithm? And if treatments for hemorrhoids, presumed hemorrhoids, are not working, then that you need to go and have yourself a colonoscopy or have it further evaluated to make sure nothing else is going on.
So it's not just young people or patients who yeah. aren't aware of this. It's also doctors.
Exactly, and that's something that we're also doing a lot of education with. I'm actually here right now with the American Cancer Society at a on a panel that's for their program called 80% by 2018, where they want 80% of Americans to be screened, appropriately screened for colorectal cancer. And so what we're doing out here is actually speaking to doctors and talking about how to reach out to their patients to make sure they get screened. But also one of the side projects I'm doing and talking to physicians about is that this can affect patients, not even of just 50-year-olds and above. It can affect a lot of us who are younger. Matter of fact, they just changed the screening guidelines for African-Americans actually are now colonoscopy at age 45 with no symptoms because of the large rate of colorectal cancer in African-Americans. And what's interesting is that in Hispanic-Americans, although they are third in terms of their rates of colorectal cancer, they are known to have colorectal cancer and to get colorectal cancer at a lot younger. And so some places like Puerto Rico have instituted screening and colonoscopy projects for patients 40 and up.
So why is that? And any hypotheses as to why younger people are now getting these cancers?
Well, you know, I think that the biggest, and this is a intelligent hypothesis, as I like to call it, is we definitely know that there is a higher obesity rate amongst younger people than there were. And I think it's that combined with consumption of a lot of processed foods and a lack of exercise. I think reality is probably all three of those. We don't know which comes first, the chicken or the egg. But we do know that in places where there's not a lot of processed foods, like Uganda has one of the lowest colorectal cancer rates in the world. People don't get it there hardly, and they eat a more plant-based diet. Okay, when people move to this country from places where they're not known because of dietary reasons to get colorectal cancer, their colorectal cancer rate jumps up to what ours is.
When you're talking about processed food, what are you talking about specifically?
Well, processed foods are things that you buy that are in a paper bag already, chips. You know, oils, French fries, things of that nature, high fatty foods. We also know that meat diets, that diets that are high in red meat, you know, the World Health Organization has finally written down and put on their list of carcinogenic foods, red meat, something that we as physicians have known for years. And now, you know, it is actually been written as a guideline for diets that are high in red meat. Also red meat consumption in and of itself can lead to a higher rate of colorectal cancer. So if you have a plant-based diet, meaning that, you know, mostly fruits and vegetables, not a lot of processed foods, things that you can just go buy and unfortunately we, you know, eat quickly, then that actually can decrease your rate of colorectal cancer. And that's hard to do, but we do know that our Western diet, I like to call it the gift and the curse of industrialization. We have access to a wide variety of foods really quickly. But a lot of these processed foods are not good for us, and we still don't know exactly why.
Okay, so right now the official recommendation for people with no family history of colorectal cancer is to begin getting screened at the age of 50. Should that be changed?
For non-African Americans. So African Americans the guideline is age 45.
Okay.
But in terms of screening age 50, yes, I think it should be changed. I mean, I most of my patients that I see have some kind of, you know, colorectal issues, may have rectal bleeding, may have some abdominal pain. I have a very cancer is always on my mind, so to speak. The key is, while those guidelines are age 50, I think they should be reduced. But more importantly, patients right now, and especially during this month, have to be their own advocate, which once again means that if you have unexplained abdominal pain that is not getting better, you go to see your physician, you try whatever treatments are recommended, but if that is not getting better, since that is one of the nonspecific symptoms of colorectal cancer, then you need to go and demand a colonoscopy. If you have rectal bleeding that's not getting better with current treatments, then you have to go discuss with your physician and talk about the next step, which is further evaluation of the colon.
But what if you have no symptoms?
Well, if you have no symptoms, then that's a great question. So if you have no symptoms, you know, it's hard. We still really don't know when you should be evaluated. If you have no symptoms plus a family history, that's a lot easier, because then those patients should get a colonoscopy. I think that the guidelines are written, and people must really remember this. Just because something is a national guideline doesn't mean that that is the absolute truth. The reality is that while we're here in Los Angeles, you can throw a rock and hit a colorectal surgeon like myself or a GI doctor, and you can get a colonoscopy right away. But in places like in the South and in rural areas, there's not a lot of gastroenterologists or colorectal surgeons to do these colonoscopies. And so if the guideline is everybody needs a colonoscopy at 40, there won't be as many people to do them.
So if the guidelines should be lowered to, you know, younger ages, but the insurance companies aren't mandated to cover that as they are now, right? Age 50 and above, they're mandated to cover?
Yes.
So
yes.
People won't necessarily get them if they
no,
can't
people
pay
would
for
have
them.
To right, or they'd have to have symptoms, meaning that, you know, blood mixed in stool or abdominal pain that is not improving. You're absolutely right. I mean, even now, with the better access to care and more screening, if a patient comes in now and I do a screening colonoscopy and I find a polyp, then all of a sudden that becomes a non-screening colonoscopy because a polyp was found. And so sometimes, you're dealing with people who are angry because you found something, which is the whole point, you know? And so if things get worse, meaning that if the coverage that we currently have, goes away, then that will actually, you know, make things worse even for people 50 and above, let alone for somebody who's younger.
Dr. Zuri Morell, colorectal surgeon and director of the Cedars-Sinai Colorectal Cancer Center. Thanks for joining us.
All right. Thank you so much.
Coming up, New Yorker writer Ariel Levy had an enviable life, married, a baby on the way at the top of her profession. And then in the space of about a month, it all fell apart.
What happened is, on the second night that I was in Ulaanbaatar in UB, I went into labor in my hotel room by myself. And for 10 minutes, I was somebody's mother. And then my son died before the ambulance got there.
Ariel Levy on the best and worst 10 minutes of her life, next on Press Play. You're listening to Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. For most of her life, Ariel Levy believed everything was possible, raised to believe that girls and women could do anything, be anything they wanted. She's a magazine writer. She often writes about extreme women because, as she admits, she's extreme herself. Ariel Levy is a staff writer at The New Yorker, and until recently, she had it all: the cush job, marriage, a baby on the way, a vacation place on Long Island. And in the space of just 1 month, it pretty much all fell apart. She lost the baby, her spouse went into rehab for alcoholism, and she had no money. Ariel Levy writes about this in her new memoir. It's called The Rules Do Not Apply, and she joins us now. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Well, at one point you write in the book, it was unseemly how successful I felt with all that stuff at your apex before it all fell apart. Why did you think it was unseemly?
Oh, I don't know. I think I probably just felt like I'd gotten away with something, you know? I mean, I felt like I'd gotten to have the job I always dreamed about, and I got to marry the person I loved, and I was going to have a baby at 38, which is, you know, already feels like getting away with something because it's late in the game. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I just felt like I was getting away with something, but I didn't get away with it.
Well, I mean, so. In a way, did you feel that way because you're a woman? I don't know how many men would say that.
I don't know. I've never been a man.
But you know what I mean? That
no,
women
I do know
are
what
always
you mean.
Told, well, you can't have it all.
I think that nobody can have it all. I mean, I think that we have this idea that that's somehow what feminism promised, and it actually isn't. I think the thinking that you can have every single thing you want in life, that's not the thinking of a feminist, that's the thinking of a toddler. You know?
Yeah. What was the quote from Maureen Dowd? You interviewed her, and she said...
I think it was like 10, 15 years ago, and I asked her, I was young at the time, and I asked her, did you ever want children? And she said, well, everybody doesn't get everything. And at the time... You know, I was in my sort of early 30s, I think, when we had that conversation. And I thought, God, that's a statement of defeat. And now I'm 42 and I think, well, of course. Duh.
Well, is that a problem that feminism has wrought perhaps, you know, unknowingly or unintentionally, but given young women this idea that they can have it all? And then when they become 38, 39, 40, they're like, oh, well, I feel cheated now.
Well, you know, I mean, I honestly think that it's like there was only that one Virginia Slims commercial with the long menthol cigarette that told us we could have it all. I don't think feminism said that. I think feminism said you are fully human. As a female person, you are a full human being. And the human condition is to not get everything you want. Nobody does. So I'm reluctant to blame feminism for this.
So do you blame anyone?
No. Mm-mm. I used to blame myself because I felt like I kind of got my comeuppance. I felt like I got what I deserved, you know, because I had made a lot of mistakes. I had cheated on my spouse. So I felt like I sort of deserved the marriage to fall apart. And you know, that's that you could make a case, right? And I felt initially... like it was my fault that I lost the baby because I went to Mongolia when I was pregnant. And despite the fact that doctors told me, oh, it's fine to fly when you're in your second trimester, which I was, I felt responsible for the loss of that child for a long time. But I sort of since learned that that's part of grief. I mean, it's self-recrimination, and particularly if you have a miscarriage. I've yet to meet a woman who's had a miscarriage who doesn't feel responsible for it. And eventually I sort of accepted the science, which is that flying isn't why you have a placental abruption, which is what I had. It was going to happen anyway.
Okay, so let's get into that story. This is, you know, the apex of the book. You're 5 months pregnant, and you decide to go on one last big overseas assignment in Mongolia, of all places. And so did you have any reservations? Did you think, maybe this isn't the best time to go? Maybe it's a little unsafe?
No, because I believe... in science, right? Like I believe in climate change, and I believe when a doctor tells me it's okay to fly, it's not unsafe, then I believe why would a doctor tell me that if it wasn't true? And it wasn't one doctor. It was many doctors. I mean, that's medical consensus that it's okay to fly in your second trimester. So no, I wasn't worried at all.
But I guess going to a place where they don't have the latest, shiniest medical facilities.
In Ulaanbaatar, where I was... the medical care was fine.
Yeah.
It just sounds dramatic.
It does.
It just sounds bad. You went to Mongolia pregnant. It sounds bad.
Okay, so what happened?
What happened is on the second night that I was in Ulaanbaatar in UB, I went into labor in my hotel room by myself. And for 10 minutes, I was somebody's mother. And that's what happened. And then my son died before the ambulance got there. And... there's nowhere in the world, I mean, you could be in New York City, it doesn't matter. There's nowhere in the world that you have a baby who's 19 weeks old and lives. That's not a thing that happens.
So what was it like during those 10 minutes?
Transcendent. Incredible. The most incredible 10 minutes of my life. I experienced maternal love. I mean, there's no other feeling quite like that. There's no love that brutal and that primal that I can imagine, you know, so that was transcendent, but then he died. And so when I got back from Mongolia, I was so sad I could barely breathe. And, you know, a switch had flipped in my heart and I felt like a mother. And a switch had flipped in my body, too. I was, you know, making milk for a baby who didn't exist. So it was sort of an identity crisis. I felt like a mother. My body thought it was somebody's mother. But to the rest of the world, you know, I didn't have a child, so I wasn't one.
And how long did you feel that way? How long were you experiencing that grief?
Years.
Years.
It really took years. I mean, I think people think, let's put it this way. Before this happened to me, if someone said they had a miscarriage, if someone said probably even that they lost, you know, that they had a stillbirth, if they lost a baby at term, I think I would have thought, oh, that's too bad. I don't think I would have had any sense that it felt to that it would have felt to that woman like she had lost her child, you know? I mean, I think that this word miscarriage, I mean, it just sounds like no big whoop. But to me, that, you know, whenever someone said, oh, you had a miscarriage, I sort of felt like that doesn't do it. That doesn't feel like the truth. What felt like the truth was this Euripides quote, what greater grief can there be for mortals than to see their children dead? That's what it felt like to me. And I've spoken to a lot, you know, since I wrote about this first for The New Yorker in an essay called Thanksgiving in Mongolia, I've heard from scores of women who've lost babies or who've had stillbirths and things like that. And it's a pretty common experience, I think. You know, when I did a reading yesterday in the Bay Area, and this woman in her 70s raised her hand afterwards, and she said, you know, I had two children who lived, and I had four pregnancies that I lost, four babies who died. She said, I'm, you know, in my 70s, and I still miss them.
Mm. If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with New Yorker writer Arielle Levy about her new memoir. It's called The Rules Do Not Apply. And so when you got back, you found that your spouse... and I'm saying spouse because you didn't really like the word wife.
No, we didn't like that. Yeah. She didn't like it any more than I did. We didn't like that.
So this is Lucy, and you were with her for, what, 10 years?
Yeah.
So you find out that she is basically drinking nonstop, that she's an alcoholic.
We'd had issues. We'd had all sorts of problems around it. I just thought it was sorted. I sort of thought it was sorted, right? Like, that's how denial... I think is. It's like you kind of think it's okay, but somewhere in your body, somewhere in the depths of yourself, you kind of know it's not okay. Mm-hmm. So I was horrified, but not really surprised when 2 weeks after I got back from Mongolia, it became clear she had to go to rehab.
So she goes into rehab, and you think you can still save the marriage?
No, I didn't. I didn't. At that point, I just felt I give up on everything, you know, like I just felt like I give. Mm-hmm. That's it. That's me done. I just felt like I didn't have any fight left in me. And I just felt like I was in this tunnel of grief. Like I felt like I was existing within grief. And then what I found interesting about grief, it's like initially it's something you live in, and then eventually it's something that lives in you. Like you asked, how long did I grieve? I mean, I think I'll always have like a little hole in my heart for that baby. And I don't aspire to have that scab up. Like, I think it's appropriate. You know, I'm that person's mother. It's appropriate that I always have a space for him.
Do you still want to be a mom?
I'd love to. Yeah. I put a lot of energy into it. I mean, after I got back from Mongolia, I tried for years to have another baby until I was physically, emotionally, and financially out of gas. I mean, just couldn't do it anymore. So now I get a break. And then maybe I'll try to adopt. But now I get a break. Now I want to just enjoy my life as it is and not be constantly reaching, grasping for something that really hurts not to get each time. I just want to be in the present.
So when you had your miscarriage in Mongolia, you were taken care of by this quite nice South African doctor, and then you struck up this email friendship with him.
Yeah. We became pen pals.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And then you now have a relationship with him.
Yeah, but I didn't write about it in my book, and I'll tell you why not. Because I felt like while it would have been technically accurate to say, and then eventually we fell in love, it would have been really misleading because it would have suggested that this person came and saved me, and that romantic love saves the day. And the fact of the matter is, falling in love again did not take away my grief at losing my baby. It didn't take away my grief at my last marriage falling apart. All it did was open up a new story, a new chapter for me, which is great, and I'm really grateful for it. But I had to find my way out of that tunnel of grief regardless.
You write close to the end of the book, I'm just going to quote this little paragraph at the end of one of your chapters, and you write, "My job is to interpret and to communicate my interpretation persuasively to other people. The idea that in life, unlike in writing, the drive to analyze and influence might be something worth relinquishing was to me a revelation." I was just wondering, in the context of this book and writing this book, how mm-hmm. you came to terms with that idea that sometimes life cannot be analyzed in the way that you're used to doing.
I mean, I think the gift of this whole experience is this understanding that I'm not in control. You know, I really think that I lived my life before this suffering from the misconception that if I was strategic and dogged enough, I could plan everything. I could, you know, be the protagonist in my own story in a way that I found after all this loss that there was only one thing to do, and that was sort of surrender and accept that things are the way they are and take a more, I don't know what other word to use, a more surrendered approach to playing out my life and just seeing, okay, we're going to see what happens here, because trying to control this is not a possibility. Mm-hmm. And that is something good. I mean, I'm glad to have been disabused of the illusion of control. I feel liberated by that. You know, I got a lot out of going to Al-Anon after my marriage ended. You know, I had not understood addiction at all. I wish I had started going sooner. I wish I'd started going much sooner.
Do you think that you could have saved your marriage if you had, or if you had been more aware of what was happening with Lucy?
I don't. Who can ever know? You know, who can ever know? It's like that way lies madness. If I start thinking, would I be a mother now if I had tried to have children earlier? Well, maybe. Or maybe I would have had a placental abruption then too. Would I have saved my marriage? Maybe. We'll never know. All I can do is sort of look at the life that's in front of me. And that's the upside of loss, is that it does have the potential to make you more grateful for what you haven't lost. So when I felt like my identity, as I was saying earlier, you know, as a mother and as a wife, just slipped out from under me, I sort of clung to my identity as a writer. That was what I had that was still intact. And as anyone who's been divorced knows, it's such a feeling of failure. I mean, I just felt like a failure at love, which I can't think of a worse thing to fail at. I can't think of anything I want to fail at less as a human being than love. So trying to value this other kind of love and these friendships that I've had with people for 20 and 30 years, that helped a lot. That got me through.
Ariel Levy, her new memoir is called The Rules Do Not Apply. Ariel, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Switching gears, coming up. He created The Dating Game, The Newlywed Game, and The Gong Show. We'll remember Chuck Barris next on Press Play.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand.
From Hollywood, almost live, it's The Gong Show.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, here's your host and the star of our show, the delectably dangerous Mr. Chuck Berry.
Chuck Barris was the brash creator and host of the infamous Gong Show. Here's how that show worked. Amateurs would come on and perform, and most of them were so terrible, the celebrity judges would bang a gong to get them off the stage when they just couldn't take it anymore. Critics hated it. They called it crass, but that didn't matter. The Gong Show was a cultural sensation. Chuck Barris died yesterday. He was 87 years old, and he leaves quite a legacy. He created the Newlywed Game, too, and the dating game. He also claimed to be a CIA assassin. Here to tell us more about the unusual life of Chuck Barris is veteran reality game show producer and Chuck Barris superfan Mandel Ilagan. Welcome.
Hi there.
Well,
thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Well, the Gong Show is what Chuck Barris is most famous for. But as I said, he first created the dating game back in 1965. And here's a little clip from that show.
An amateur musician, the piano is her instrument. She's also been a song leader in school. She hopes to become a teacher from Whittier, California. Maybe welcome to the dating game, Donna Harris. Hello, Donna.
Okay, that music. Wow, that takes me back.
Yeah.
What was the dating game? Was it a game changer?
Yeah. I mean, you know, like many of Chuck's shows, if you look at what was on daytime television, particularly with game shows around the 60s, there were very straightforward, very game-centric shows, shows where you had to have some skill or knowledge to win, say, like a password or the original Jeopardy with Art Fleming. What Chuck's shows did, particularly Dating Game, was like the people were the game, their personalities. I mean, you know, the prize was winning a date, and how you won was whether showing the bachelorette or the bachelor that you were more compatible than the other two that you were up against. So it really kind of revolutionized how the game show and really the sort of unscripted genre of that time was done.
Yeah. And then the Newlywed Game, similar.
Exactly. Yeah. It's how well do you know your partner? I mean, these weren't necessarily fact-based trivia style questions. I mean, this was about getting to know people's lives and often finding, you know, amusing secrets about what goes on in their household.
Yeah. It was all pretty saucy, right? With sexual innuendo.
Especially for that time. Yeah.
Okay, and so then comes the Gong Show in the mid-1970s. That show is just off the hook, crazy.
Yeah.
I mean, really. There were frequent flyers on the show like Gene Gene the Dancing Machine, The Unknown Comic. Did you have a favorite?
I would have to say Gene Gene the Dancing Machine. When you heard that signature theme song for Gene Gene, you know there was going to be there was going to be a party going on. Everybody was going to be dancing. The game was stopped. And, you know, as it progressed, it just got even more insane as the years went on the Gong Show. I mean, there would be Gene Gene dancing and then people would be throwing stuff from the audience. And, I mean, just look up any clip online and it was like it was a party. And think about this. This was happening on daytime television in the middle of the day. On NBC daytime. I mean, it was unlike any other thing at that time.
Okay, we have a clip of Chuck Barris talking about one of his favorite acts, and here's a clip from that.
This one time I brought down one of those abominable acts, one of those acts I didn't think they could possibly use, called the Popsicle Twins. And they were two little 17 or 18-year-old girls, you know, well-built little pubescent things there that skipped out onto the stage and sat down and they just licked these orange popsicles in a very intriguing manner. And the censor never said a word. I don't think they were in the studio. And then I thought to myself, well, maybe they were not so bad. And I put them on the air. And of course, the phones lit up all over the country and it was bedlam.
How did that get on the air? How did any of it get on the air?
I mean, honestly, I don't know how that particular act, because I've seen it, got through. I mean, maybe the standards person from the network, which was NBC at the time, didn't quite get the double entendre that was in that act. or as Chuck said, they weren't there. But it was one of those things where you look, it's like, oh my gosh, I cannot believe this is happening. And if you that clip is online, if you see the judges' faces, I mean, you had Jamie Farr, you had Phyllis Diller, you had J.P. Morgan, and that in itself, their reactions were hilarious. Especially Phyllis Diller. I mean, she just, I don't know if she didn't get it or she was offended by it, but she did not like it. And then you see J.P. Morgan, who loved it. And she has, I forget what the one-liner is, but you got to see that clip. It is just a spot-on reaction to that particular act.
Okay, well, most of the acts were just regular people performing badly.
Yeah.
For instance, there's like an old lady dressed like a cowgirl with a pistol, and she's just singing off key. And you know, people are laughing at her. Was the show mean-spirited?
You know, I mean, there can be an argument made for that. But I think for the most part, you saw people having fun. And you saw people having their shot at sharing, you know, their quirky talent. I mean, we see that a lot on reality shows today. I think what is great about what Chuck Barris did is you see a lot of his legacy in unscripted shows today. I mean, take, for instance, The Gong Show. That had to have some influence on shows like American Idol or America's Got Talent.
Yeah.
And the thing that Chuck's shows did that you may not necessarily see in a lot of unscripted shows today is that there was this air of fun. It's the celebration, if you will, of the weird, the celebration of being yourself. And maybe there was some level of, you know, embarrassment in it. But at the end of the day, they were having fun. It was all very low stakes. It was all for just kind of being who you were. I mean, that's the thing that a lot of these shows that he did were being who you were and not being ashamed about it. And I think that's so, one of the key things of any of his shows that he did.
So was he and were the judges, were they pretty much drunk the entire time?
You know, I've actually, he had been asked that question. And from what I understand, no, he wasn't. I think from what people tell me, I've worked with people who've known him, you know, he was actually a very kind of shy guy. And this was sort of like, maybe he was, I don't want to speak for him, but maybe it was overcompensated, but he by no means was he on any sort of substance. That can't be verified. I can't say for any of the judges, but you have to understand, you know, it was the 70s and on many other game shows of the time, you were doing shows, you were taping these shows often 5 shows a day.
Yeah.
And what that often entailed was you would do to your 2 shows or your 3 shows. You'd have a very generous lunch break with a very generous helping of assortments of things. And sometimes you could tell watching a show, watching a week's worth of shows, which were done after the lunch break. Again, I can't say for sure if that necessarily happened on The Gong Show, but I've heard on some other game shows of the time that, oh, you know, was the norm when you had a celebrity panel on a show.
All right. Okay, well, at least we know Chuck Barris was high on life.
Yes, exactly. Right.
Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. My pleasure. Mandel Ilagin, veteran reality game show producer, Chuck Barris superfan. We've been remembering Chuck Barris, who died yesterday at the age of 87. Hi, Julie Myers.
Hi. Very quickly, if you want to share your love of Chuck Barris on our Facebook page, KCRW Press Play, especially if you're Pee Wee Herman, who made his debut on that show.
Oh, fascinating. Mm. Thank you for that tidbit.
Mm-hmm.
Julie Myers. All right. Thank you for listening. I'm Madeline Brand, and I will see you tomorrow.